up another notch today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump's fiery rhetoric against North Korea might be playing right into Kim Jong-un's hands.
To get the U.S. president to react this strongly is probably something that made Pyongyang quite happy.
North Korea's latest threat is aimed at U.S. military facilities in Guam. The island's governor is not amused.
An attack or threat on Guam is a threat or attack on the United States. We are not just a military installation.
And later, it's a tough life for stray golden retrievers in Istanbul.
Because they don't know how to fight for their food. And when big dogs approach the food, the golden retrievers run away.
Now some of those strays are coming here. Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World.
Today was a huge day.
Yep, I'll say. A huge day for the people of Guam, like journalist Dana Williams there. Guam's 160,000-some residents woke up today with their Pacific Island home smack in the middle of a war of words between North Korea and President Trump. North Korea's repeated taunts against the U.S., President Trump's fire and fury response yesterday, followed by North Korea's threat to create an enveloping fire on Guam and the American military installations on this little U.S. territory in the Pacific. It's all a bit surreal and, when you're talking potential nuclear war, yes, pretty scary, which makes it a bit too real for the people of Guam. Guam's Governor Eddie Bazacalvo issued a statement earlier today. Among other things, he said his staff is in communication with officials in Washington to make sure the island is safe.
An attack or threat on Guam is a threat or attack on the United States. They have said that America will be defended. And I also want to remind the national media that Guam is American soil. And we have 200,000 Americans in Guam and the Marianas. We are not just a military installation.
The governor stressed that currently there is no real threat to the island. Earlier, I asked Dana Williams if Guam residents are feeling anxious today. Williams is editor of the Pacific Daily News in Guam.
Well, there's obviously some anxiety out there. This is not the first time that Guam has been threatened by North Korea. I mean, I remember in the 90s, they were talking about developing a missile that could hit Guam with a nuclear warhead. Of course, then it was sometime in the distant future. As the years have gone on, we've watched the technology develop.
If you would, paint us a picture of the island. Like, how tropical and American does it look? Does it feel like a far-flung island, or does it look more like Miami?
Doesn't look anything like Miami. Much of the island is very tropical. There are beautiful, stunningly beautiful beaches and, limestone cliffs, lots of jungle, very thick jungle. And it is very remote. It's hard to get and very expensive to get to and from here and to other places. It's interesting when people say, oh, are people evacuating Guam? It's like, it's not really like we have any place to go.
I just want to end with an excerpt of U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who's speaking and playing down Trump's warnings. And he's saying that the U.S. doesn't want to topple the North Korean government. Here's Secretary Tillerson.
Publicly, we've been pretty clear in our statements directed at the North Koreans as to what we would like to see happen and to make clear to them that we do not seek to be a threat to them.
So, Dana, how are those reassurances coming from the Secretary of State sitting with the people of Guam? Are they more inclined to believe Tillerson or Trump?
When we've talked to people today about what do you see as Trump's role in this. I mean, some people have said, well, he's exacerbating the situation. And other people say, well, I'm confident that he'll do the right thing. So, there are mixed feelings out there in the community, just as there are in the rest of the United States. And, unlike the rest of the United States, we actually don't get to vote for president.
Do you think people in Guam feel a bit like a pawn right now? Because this is a big geopolitical game, and it's suddenly like Guam is in the center of it. And they don't get a vote.
Yeah, there's that. I don't know. Most of the conversations are not really focused on the bigger geopolitical game. It's focused on, there's a direct threat to the island.
Dana Williams, editor of the Pacific Daily News in Guam. The bigger geopolitical issues are on the mind of Jean Lee right now. She's a former AP bureau chief in North Korea. Lee now lives in Seoul. So if you can, Gene, take us inside the head of Kim Jong-un and the North Korean government. Trump's warning sounded incredibly incendiary and unprecedented to a lot of us. But how do you think they heard it in Pyongyang?
I'm going to venture to guess that Pyongyang was actually kind of pleased by the reaction. And I know that sounds a little bit twisted, but one of the things that North Korea wants is to get on the radar of the U.S. president. And this is something that would give him some legitimacy at home. And we have to keep in mind that one of the things that Kim Jong-un wants to do is to show his people that the world takes him seriously, in particular, the United States, the superpower.
So what do you think North Korea is going to do? What are the most likely scenarios here, in your opinion?
Well, I know there's a lot of media attention right now on the possibility of war. But I have to tell you that nobody in South Korea is panicking at the moment. And that should tell you something about how accustomed the region is to this kind of rhetoric. And also, I doubt in Pyongyang that they're panicking as well. People have been through this, and I think that they know that when it comes down to it, nobody, not even the North Koreans, want to wage another war. I do think that there is something that we have to worry about, which is the risk of a miscalculation or a mishap of some sort, because the leaders do feel that they have to follow their words with action. Mm-hmm. And we've seen in the past that some of these tensions have tipped over into conflict. I mean, I was here in 2010 when a mishap or miscommunication between South Korea and North Korea ended up with this artillery exchange on a frontline island, and civilians were killed. So certainly what you don't want with hundreds of thousands of troops poised to take action is for somebody to feel that they have to make a move.
I mean, this whole sense of calm that you say South Koreans are feeling right now, it's kind of the same sense of calm that you've expressed in the past when there have been these kind of freakouts over the latest developments in North Korea. I mean, it does feel, at least from our perch here, that we've entered this new territory with, you know, the president of the United States talking about fire and fury that the world has not seen. I mean, is it really still calm there?
It's unbelievable. You know, I woke up this morning to the news of Trump's comments, and it was a bit of a shock. But then you go out into the streets, and there was really no panic whatsoever. I do sometimes tell South Koreans that they do have to pay attention to this because we have reached a new phase in a certain sense, which is that North Korea has developed its nuclear program far faster than experts had predicted, and that they've got some very dangerous weapons. And so we should be concerned that they are continuing to build ballistic missiles and that they are perhaps building dozens of nuclear weapons without any kind of oversight by international nuclear experts. So this could be a disaster in the making. That said, I do think that a lot of this is rhetoric, both from the White House, or I should say from New Jersey, and also from Pyongyang.
So if Trump is all about fire and fury and his Secretary of State Tillerson says we can sit down and talk with North Korea under certain conditions, assess for us how willing the West is to appease this volatile nation in some way without looking like it's giving in to Kim.
That is the challenge. And I think that really the only way out of this is at some point to get to that negotiating table and to talk to North Koreans. Frankly, it may not seem like that's what they want, but that is what they want.
Gene Lee in Seoul, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Gene Lee is a global fellow at the Wilson Center. She's based in Seoul. We'll have more on the hot diplomatic rhetoric and when it's used later here on The World. Golden Retrievers are consistently one of the most popular dog breeds in the U.S. In Turkey, though, Goldens are filling up animal shelters. So a group of volunteers has been working to bring these unwanted purebreds to the U.S. Alexandra Locke caught up with some of the travelers on their last day in Istanbul.
It's almost 6,000 miles from Istanbul to Atlanta. It's going to be a long flight, and the passengers need to stretch their legs. All four legs. This is not the departures terminal. We're in the Ataturk Airport cargo hall, a vast, echoey hangar full of forklifts, packages, and 18 empty dog crates. They're slowly being filled by golden retrievers of every possible hue, from pearly white to burnished bronze. The dogs seem a little overwhelmed by the airport, but they're cooperating.
Clara is going in a big crate because she's fat. We have an obese Clara. She's going in a suite.
That's Edna. She asked to only use her first name. For 2 years, she and her fellow volunteers have been coaxing these dogs into crates to go to America. Right now, they're doing it for the thousandth time, with a light golden named Atlanta. She was found as a 9-month-old puppy outside Istanbul in May, but she's close to full size now.
Atlanta and her sister Phoenix were found in the Çatalca forests, abandoned most probably by breeders.
Everyone wants a picture before they leave. Atlanta is named for her new home, the first American city to take in Goldens from Turkey.
An American notified us and said there are beautiful purebred Goldens in shelters over here.
That's Lauren Jenkinger. She's the founder of Adopt a Golden Atlanta.
And we couldn't believe it. And we had found that these are Goldens that have lived in outdoor shelters for 5 to 7 years of their life.
As she knows well, the Golden Retriever puppy is basically the cutest thing in the world. In Turkey, they're kind of a status symbol, and they make trendy presents. But people don't realize quite how much love, attention, and fur they're signing up for. That's how these dogs end up in Turkish shelters. Adoption is not a big thing here, so they're not likely to find a home in Turkey. The U.S., that's another story.
There's 95 rescues in the country. Every one of us have waiting lists for adoptions for a golden retriever. And so we believe that if we have people waiting to adopt them, then why not give them wonderful homes in America?
The volunteers have airlifted Goldens to 15 states and Canada, and there's plenty more where they came from. By some estimates, Istanbul is home to 100,000 stray dogs. Edna says the Goldens in particular have it hard on the streets.
Because they are calm, they don't know how to fight for their food. And when big dogs approach the food, the golden retrievers run away.
With Atlanta and her fellow travelers fed, watered, and loaded away, the Turkish volunteers say goodbye, while the dogs start their screening procedures to fly. The next evening, Lauren and her team are there to greet them in Atlanta.
Okay, this is the 1,000th dog. She's going to have to go to the bathroom.
She's coming out.
Now, you might be thinking, it feels a little strange to roll out the welcome mat for non-human immigrants when Turkey alone is hosting 3 million Syrian refugees. And it's not lost on the Turkish volunteers just how lucky these dogs are. One of them told me, it's a little funny that if I were the one applying for a U.S. visa, I might not get it. But the way Edna and Lauren see it, none of that means these dogs shouldn't have a better life.
I don't even think that dogs and humans are different, but I have chosen to help dogs. We get this question all the time. Say,
Edna says she turns the question around.
So what do you do about Syrians? Oh, I don't have time, I don't have money. So I say, I'm sorry, but I help dogs. It's my choice.
And it's not cheap. Lauren points out this all-volunteer enterprise easily costs $2,000 to $3,000 per dog, along with a headache of paperwork.
They do have their passports. They're healthy, and we are following all the laws. So they are legal immigrants.
With all the screenings the dogs go through once they arrive, it can take 7 months before they're in a permanent home. And it's not just the physical checks. There's some cross-cultural training to do as well.
We say they're bilingual. They've taught us all of the basic commands for training dogs, such as sit is otur, gel is come, toop is ball. They don't seem to know that. I don't know if they have a lot of tennis balls over there.
Despite the language barrier, Lauren says most of the Goldens adapt easily to their new homes. The dogs don't know. They've crossed half the world to get there. For The World, Alexandra Locke, Istanbul.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The World in Words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The World in Words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Here's a dilemma many South African women face every day. What do you do when a man refuses to wear a condom? South Africa is home to the largest HIV-positive population in the world, nearly 20% of adults, and women are twice as likely as men to become infected with the virus. But even in the face of those realities, many men refuse to wear condoms. The good news is there are some groundbreaking new methods being tested to prevent HIV, methods that, if approved, would give women more control in protecting themselves. Jasmine Garst with our Across Women's Lives team has our story from Johannesburg.
Zianda Kante says she knew her husband was cheating on her. And she knew a lot about the HIV epidemic. Her aunt died of AIDS-related tuberculosis. So when her husband demanded sex, Zianda tried to demand that he use condoms.
There were times that he would beat me up just because I said to him, when he wants us to be sexual active, then I will ask him to wear a condom because I will say, I refused. So I was trying to protect myself, but he didn't see that way.
Here's the question that's stumping healthcare workers and activists. If over 7 million HIV infections nationwide don't convince a man to wear a condom, what will? Zianda just gave up.
And so I left him in 2011, and then I came here.
Tired of playing Russian roulette with her health, she moved with her kids to Cape Town. And one of the first things she noticed in her new neighborhood, tucked into the maze of tiny houses, was the Desmond Tutu HIV Foundation. The research center was conducting a drug trial, a new way for women to prevent getting HIV. Zianda has these marvelous dimples that deepen when she smiles with pride. For her, participating in this study was personal.
I was so happy and excited that finally I have something that I'm going to be the part of.
It definitely might hold the key.
Dr. Catherine Gill is the lead researcher in this study. She's holding the key in the palm of her hand, except the key is a white, soft silicone ring. It looks like birth control, but it's not.
It's impregnated with an antiretroviral, and it comes out in slow release from the ring over a month.
This ring would give women a whole new degree of control over HIV prevention. If used consistently, the ring has a 60% efficacy rate. That might not sound like a lot, but Gill says if this gets licensed,
it will avert at least a million HIV infections over the next 20 years.
In order for the ring to work, though, a woman has to put it in, and she can do it herself, and keep it in for 28 days. It should not be removed until she replaces it with a new one. Here's the thing, though. Throughout the trials, many women did remove it.
What this virus has taught us is that you can be a researcher, you can design something amazing, and then people don't use it.
One reason is when some men find out, they see it as a sign of promiscuity and demand that their girlfriends and wives remove it.
Sometimes participants will say that their partners pulled it out, thrown it away. We've had a couple of occasions where participants have been beaten up.
So what's it going to take for women to protect themselves from HIV?
It's getting to a point where you even think, okay, where do I see myself in the next 5 years? Will I form part of the statistics, you know?
Awilani Nuwala is 21 years old. She lives in Hillbrow, Johannesburg. It's one of the most crime-ridden neighborhoods in the country. As a young woman, she knows the odds are against her. She's twice as likely to become HIV infected than men her age. Also, there's a crisis of violence against women in South Africa.
There's a high risk of a lot of things that can happen to me as a young woman, for example, being raped. So having such options to prevent myself from being HIV positive or to contract the disease, it makes me feel more safe.
This is why researchers are pushing hard on another study, one that is even more discreet than the vaginal ring. It's called HPTN84. In everyday English, that's a long-lasting injectable that would protect people from HIV.
We have to do what is called a phase 3 trial, which is a very large trial involving many thousands of men and women.
Dr. Sinead Delaney-Moretlwe is an HIV researcher here in Johannesburg. She chairs the upcoming clinical trials for this injectable.
Part of the work that we've been doing is to think about how we can support young women to use these products, because the same factors that shape their HIV risk also shape how they can or can't use these products.
Imagine, says Awilani, the young woman from Hillbrow, if every 8 weeks she could just get an injection and carry on with her life. It would be so much easier than the pill version.
If the injectable option is approved, I'd rather go for the injectable option than taking the pill every day. Because at my age, having to set a timetable, schedule to take this pill at this day, this time, it can be very stressful, you know. Yeah, so I would use it.
The human tests for the injectable start later this year. They're going to enroll 3,200 women throughout Africa. The trial will carry on until 2021. That's a long time, but Awolani is so excited she joined the advisory board to help recruit participants. She says this could change her everyday life.
Even when I walk on the street, I know that there's something that's protecting me, you know.
This is a lot of workaround to circumvent some big issues, like violence against women and men refusing to wear protection. But for women like Ziyanda and Awolani, that fight requires more time than they have. This is urgent. This is their time to take control, any way they can. For The World, Jasmine Garst, Johannesburg, South Africa.
Tomorrow we'll hear about another way some South African women say they're taking control. It involves demanding money and gifts in exchange for a relationship with an older man. It's not a new phenomenon, but activists say it's fueling the current HIV epidemic in South Africa. For this man, having a number of beautiful women at his beck and call is the norm.
I need a hot girl. I'm sure you understand when I use those words of hot.
What it means to be blessed and what it means to be the blesser. We'll get the full story tomorrow here on the show. Here's another story you'll hear tomorrow on The World. An independent nation the size of Connecticut sits on the Arizona-Mexico border. The people of the Tohono-O'odham Nation cross the border easily, but that could change.
You know, there's all these unanswered questions. You know, there's people that are just scared. You know, I'm, you know, in a way I am too, because it's like if this wall were to go through, then what else can President Trump take away from us? And a lot of people, by a lot of people, I mean tribal members, feel the same way where it's, you know, is he going to take our sovereignty away? What if that happens? Where do we go from there? You know, can President Trump, can he kick us off of our own land? You know, all these questions are coming up and they're good questions.
People at the border talk about the president's wall. That's tomorrow on The World.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Sujata Gidla grew up in India, a member of the country's lowest caste.
I was ashamed of admitting that I was an untouchable. I would not tell anybody that I was an untouchable.
Now she's written a book about her experiences in between shifts driving a New York City subway train. Her story ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Fire and Fury, unfortunately, we've heard and seen it before. In fact, today is the 72nd anniversary of the second atomic bomb that the U.S. dropped on Japan in Nagasaki. From the archives, here is President Harry Truman in August of 1945, warning Japan to accept America's terms of surrender.
If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth.
Yesterday, we heard an echo of Truman's 1945 statement when President Trump made this comment in New Jersey.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
After hearing that, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un upped the ante, saying he was considering a strike on the American territory of Guam that would create an enveloping fire around the island. PJ Crowley has had a good deal of experience both listening to and speaking the language of diplomacy and war. PJ is a former State Department spokesman who served under President Obama. An interesting juxtaposition there of Trump and Truman. Truman inherited, of course, a long war from FDR. It had ended in Europe, but the Japanese wouldn't surrender. His choices were horrible. Trump also inherited the Korean War, you could say. What did you hear in each president just now, PJ?
clearly to the people of Japan and the people of South Korea who face the immediate consequences of this war of words, it's a very sobering prospect. In fairness to President Trump, he is confronting a situation that his predecessors didn't, that on the current trajectory, North Korea is going to eventually obtain a nuclear capability and the means to deliver that capability. And so President Trump has to figure out, in conjunction with our allies in the region, precisely what to do about it and what we ultimately can live with.
Almost doubling down today at the Defense Department, Secretary James Mattis said the DPRK, referring to North Korea, should cease any consideration of actions that would lead to the end of its regime and the destruction of its people. That's at the Defense Department. How alarmed would the State Department you served in be by the fire and fury comment we heard yesterday?
Well, I think the question here is there a strategy, you know, behind the president's rhetoric? And certainly we've heard from Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in recent days inviting North Korea to resume a dialogue regarding, you know, its missile tests and nuclear ambitions, with important caveats that the conversation were to take place would be about North Korea ceasing its missile activity and once again agreeing to give up its nuclear program. Mm. And what we don't have here, which we have had in previous crises, is an active diplomatic process that could serve as a firebreak.
Well, maybe it helps to have aggressive rhetoric, because Secretary Tillerson was saying that Trump was sending a clear diplomatic message in language that Kim Jong-un would understand. So in what kind of circumstances does this aggressive language have the desired effect?
Well, certainly a war of words that remains a war of words. We've had these kinds of hostile exchanges before. The risk here is that the escalator keeps going up to where rhetoric turns to action. And then if North Korea were to fire another missile, how does the United States respond and what do we do about that? So this rhetoric continues to intensify. You know, the risk of miscalculation rises, and then the prospect here is some sort of an action-reaction cycle that brings us to a place we've never been before.
You must have seen how word choice in any situation, but certainly scenarios where the stakes are very high, when you were at the State Department as spokesman, how this can be a game changer. What's the best example you recall where kind of rhetoric suddenly turns to action?
Well, certainly we've been in this general vicinity before. In 1994, the United States almost went to war with North Korea when it declined giving IAEA inspectors access to its nuclear facilities, a requirement under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. You know, now that situation was resolved through diplomatic action, and that's what we don't have here. We don't have an active diplomatic process. You know, so, you know, the real question here is between, you know, U.S. pressure, Chinese pressure. You know, we can steer North Korea to an off-ramp where it, at a minimum, freezes its current capability, decides not to do further missile and nuclear testing, and then you're able to catch your breath and see what is actually possible.
P.J. Crowley, former spokesman at the State Department, thank you very much, as always.
Always a pleasure, Marco.
It's been a little over a year since Auschwitz survivor and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel died. He was celebrated around the globe as an activist and a writer, and for his lifelong efforts to keep the world from forgetting the horrors of the Holocaust. But for his only child, Elisha, coming to terms with who his father was and what he represented was a difficult road, he says. We reached Elisha Wiesel at Goldman Sachs in New York, where he's the chief information officer.
I think earlier in my life, I was probably underappreciative of just how amazing a father I had and what he meant to the world. You have to understand, I went to a Jewish day school as a teenager, and my entire life, I felt, was being defined in terms of being his son. So there were definitely some difficulties. There were also some amazing experiences that I was able to receive, you know, traveling the world, being chased by KGB agents in the Russian subway system because we were trying to bring Jewish materials to refuseniks who weren't allowed to practice their religion freely. So definitely some amazing experiences alongside that.
How old were you when you were chased by KGB agents?
Well, I was told we were being chased by KGB agents. I have to be honest, I never saw them. I remember we were running around that subway system a lot, and we were switching trains, and everybody looked very nervous. But this was probably around age 8 or 9, so this must have been in the late 70s, early 80s.
So you're an only child, correct?
Yeah, I have a half-sister from my mom's side. She was previously married.
What kind of additional pressure, though, was that on essentially an only child to be, you know, in the shadow of Elie Wiesel?
Look, you know, my father, he felt a tremendous obligation to keep Jewish learning alive and to keep Jewish identity alive across generations. And he has been very clear with me, certainly when I was younger, that he saw me as a continuation of that. I had been to a Jewish school for 14 years, and by the time I got out, I was interested in almost everything else other than to, you know, keep studying my roots. And, you know, I remember some very tense arguments, you know, me saying, please don't burden me with the thinking of thousands of years ago. I want the freedom to go where I want to go in life. And this is what it means to be alive and to have choices. And occasionally, you know, he would say, look, you know, you should remember you have your own tradition here, one that many people, you know, died in order to perpetuate, one that your grandparents observed. You know, you should consider remembering that you have this as well, because I don't want to be the last in the chain. I want you to continue having a Jewish identity.
And today, do you feel like you've returned to that identity, those roots? And what does that feel like? And when did that kind of return start, if you will?
Look, it's interesting. I think there are probably two major focal points for me. One would be the birth of my first child, my son, who is now 11. And then the second would be the passing of my father. Those were two major life milestones for me. And I think I've realized that one doesn't have to stop living in modernity or embracing the incredible avenues of thought and expression that are available to us today, with the internet at our fingertips, with so many cultures that are available for us to study and interact with. And that doesn't have to be in conflict with being very rooted in where one comes from.
Today, what do you want people to know about what you're doing and that carries on from what your father was doing?
Look, I think people should know that I'm a loving son who remembers my father, you know, with great affection, and I'm seeing him and hearing him in ways that strangely maybe I didn't even when he was alive. And I still feel he's very much with me. And I hope that for those who are also missing him or thinking of him and wishing that his voice was still with us, I think it's up to all of us to take a moral stance on issues that require our attention and not shy away from them. And whether you're a middle school student deciding whether or not to help the kid that's getting picked on because he's weaker or less popular, whether you're a diplomat deciding how to handle a situation where the decisions you make will have ramifications for real flesh and blood human beings on a large scale. And then when I think about continuing his legacy, I very much think of it on a personal level, though. I think about how am I raising my kids and what messages am I sending them? Because he was a real family man, and he believed very much in this transmission of personal legacy as well. So I'd say I'm you know, 90% consumed with how I think of his personal legacy as a father, and much less about how I'm thinking about continuing my father's legacy on a global scale.
Elisha Wiesel, son of Elie Wiesel, and he's the chief information officer at Goldman Sachs. In India, the office of president is mostly ceremonial. Most of the power is held by the country's prime minister. But the recent election of the current president, Ram Nath Kovind, was big news in India and beyond. That's because he's a Dalit, a member of one of the lowest castes in India, known as the Untouchables. So his election sent a powerful message against the discrimination many Dalits still face. Good news, right? But for the woman in our next story, it does little to ease years of pain and suffering, even though she's living in New York City, thousands of miles from India. The world's Shirin Jafari has our story.
Do you want to describe where we are?
We are at 95th Street, Berridge.
And you're about to start your shift.
Yes.
If New York's subway system had its own reality show, Sujatha Gidda would be one of its stars. Co-workers greet her with a hug. One lends her his gloves.
I have an extra set of browns. Let me see if I can find that.
Her uniform is crisp and clean, her hair tied back. She puts on bulky ear mufflers, then adjusts her goggles.
Okay. This is a Manhattan-bound R train. Next stop will be 86th Street. Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Sujatha may well be New York's first Indian female conductor. But a few years ago in India, her life was very different. She was born into an untouchable family, meaning she was an outcast.
The best way to explain caste is to take racism here, because racism is also based on birth. So caste is like racism, except that we're not differentiated by skin color.
One way untouchables are differentiated is through the jobs they hold. Historically, they worked in the fields, cleaned human waste, did the work nobody else wanted. Upper caste Indians considered them impure, not to be touched. This discrimination was outlawed in India in 1955, but the prejudice continues today. Sujatha is one of the luckier untouchables. She managed to go to a school set up by Canadian missionaries. But, she says, in India, your life is your caste. Your caste is your life.
There was one girl in my class. She just hated me. She said, you're sneezing on me. You're sitting next to me. The woman said finally that I can't sit with that untouchable in the same class. So she quit and left.
One in six Indians is an untouchable, or Dalit, which means oppressed in Hindi. And sometimes, Sujatha says, the abuse and discrimination gets so bad, some of them resort to suicide. Last year, for example, a Dalit student in India hanged himself in his dorm room. He left a note saying how being an untouchable made his life hard. In the past decade, at least 22 other Dalit students have reportedly committed suicide. Sujatha's break from all this came in the 1990s, when she came to New York City. On her way to work, moving through New York City traffic in an Uber, she told me about her first days in America. Like how her American friends were shocked when she told them in India she wasn't allowed to drink from the same water fountain as her upper caste classmates. And then she had to get used to the idea that in this country, her caste doesn't define her.
They don't treat me, oh, she is outcast Indian. I mean, it doesn't mean that America is a great place that is free of prejudices and bigotry and hate. They do have that, but they don't have caste prejudice, so I am subjected to one less prejudice.
One less prejudice meant she could thrive, and she has.
This is Cortlandt Street, connection to the PATH trains, next stop, City Hall stand.
Besides helping New Yorkers move through the city every day, Sujatha is now an author. Her memoir, called Ants Among Elephants, was published last month. It got strong reviews. It's exciting to see it come to life, she says, but it's not like it will end the plight of untouchables in India.
People will read about it. Oh, there is such a bad thing in India. They will realize maybe some one or two of them possibly try to find, oh, what should I do? Who should I join to fight this kind of injustice? But in general, this whole thing is not going to help change the condition of untouchables.
Still, that doesn't stop her from sharing her story with the world. Because here, Sujatha is not ashamed of who she is. She's no longer untouchable. For the world, Shirin Jafari, New York City.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. African countries are increasingly interested in space exploration. In fact, the African Union has an initiative to coordinate the efforts of space agencies across the continent. Now, Ghana has raised the bar by launching its first satellite into orbit. It's called a CubeSat, a type of miniature satellite used for research. And it was launched by a small engineering team at Ghana's All Nations University with help from NASA. Dr. Richard Demwa is an associate research scientist at NASA and the director of the Space Systems and Technology Lab that built the satellite in Ghana. Congratulations, Richard. How does this all feel?
It feels great. This is a historic moment for our country, and we have been looking ahead for this for a very long time. So we feel very great and very happy.
When did the plans for the satellite actually begin?
So the president of the university conceived this idea somewhere 2012. With most of his traveling, he realized that satellite technology was one of the technologies that was missing in the various universities back in Ghana. So they started by building a amateur ground station. So with this ground station, we were able to observe any low orbit satellite that overpasses the location. And so with that in place, we then started the idea of building this satellite. So we had some of our students that graduated from electronic and communication engineering. We decided to send them to Japan to undergo training in satellite technology. The building of the satellite itself took us about 2 years.
Mm. Take me back to those Ghanaian universities. Why did they feel the need to have satellite technology in the first place?
We think countries that have gone far in terms of satellite technology have really developed. Satellite technology has a wide range of applications. So, for instance, there is this activity that is going on in Ghana that is a real headache for the government, which we call illegal mining activities.
Mm. Activities. You've got a lot of gold in Ghana,
yes,
don't you?
Yes. Then people are illegally undertaking this activity, and they are polluting the various water bodies, also destroying our vegetations and the environment as a whole. So it's a headache for the government. And we think we can even monitor such an activity from space. And also you talk about telecommunications and then TV transmissions. You see that there are some parts of the country you go, you don't get reception. But we think if we are able to incorporate all these areas into satellite technology, then some of these problems will be solved.
You did not get official government support, though, not from the Ghanaian government for your project. Why not?
That is true. I mean, I think the reason might be that perhaps they were skeptical of what we wanted to do because we have never done that before. So you go to the government and you say, you know, give me funds to launch a satellite. I think they will be a little bit hesitant to do that. But after this first launch, now the government is coming in and they assured us of the government support, which we think will really help in our next GhanaSat-2 that we are planning.
When is that planned for? Do you have a date yet?
Well, currently what we have been told by the government is to bring our plan as well as our budget. So that's what we are working on now.
That's an encouraging sign of support
from
the government.
Oh, yes, yes.
You did get that support, though, from Japan. What was their interest in training you up and providing you the resources?
They recognized we were babies in that field, right? Mm. So they wanted to nurture us in the field of satellite technology.
The African Union actually has signaled that it wants to make space exploration a part of its agenda. Ghana would seem to be out in front on this. Why do you think there is so much interest in Africa?
I think, as I said earlier, there is a lot of interest in satellite technology because of the things that you can do with satellite. Even in addition to the technology, I think it also brings economical benefits to the country as well as the continent. Mm. And I think that is why the AU is now interested in moving the whole agenda into that direction.
Richard Demua is an associate research scientist at NASA. He also directs the lab that built Ghana's first satellite. One of the things about space, it's a great place for radio waves to travel and just keep going for a long time. So it's possible, I imagine, to travel into deep space and hear an episode of The World from a few years ago or an old radio hit from way back.
Southern nights. Have you ever felt a southern night?
When I heard the news yesterday that Glenn Campbell had died, I was reminded how surprised I was when I learned some years ago that it was a Creole musician from New Orleans who wrote Southern Nights, Alan Toussaint. It changed the way I heard the song. Glen Campbell took Southern Nights to the top of the country and pop charts, a quasi-psychedelic song from the Big Easy about African Americans finding quiet solace away from the unpleasantness of big, noisy cities. That wasn't the only New Orleans connection for Glen Campbell. The rowdy funk act The Meters covered a Glen Campbell hit written by his songwriting muse Jimmy Webb. The Meters gave Wichita Lineman an atypical mellow treatment for them. But let me offer you another cover of Glen Campbell's hit from Jamaica. The late Dennis Brown recorded this when he was all of 15 years old.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the south for another overload. I hear you singing in the wires. I can hear you through the line, and the Wichita Lineman is still on the line.
Still 15 years old, what an incredible voice. That's Dennis Brown giving some love to another singer with an incredible voice, the late Glen Campbell. And that's where we leave you today. Not the modern world of satellites and digital mapping, but the old analog world of telephone lines. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in.
Stay in the street.
PRI, Public Radio International.